As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. It is a name that all within Bloomberg 1200 know if they pay attention to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. Gavin grew up in the venue north of the Charles River from Cambridge over to Revere and had a storied career in the FBI through Denver, Miami, and then in New York, including a tour of duty during the bombings of 1992. He's a former Federal Bureau of Investigation assistant director who darkened the door a few years ago at Boston College. David, why don't you bring in William Gavin?
Yeah, William Gavin, great to have you with us here on Bloomberg Surveillance. Joining us on our phone lines, Bill, I was rereading this morning the testimony that James Comey's expected to give today. And something I wondered about is the historical relationship between the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the executive branch. What's it been like? How much has that changed over the FBI's history?
I think over the history, it's been basically the same. Relationships have been warmer with the White House and cooler with the White House. All depends. I think you can recall it when Louis Freeh was director. He gave up his badge to the White House during the last year. He was with Clinton and never went to the White House again. So there are different kinds of relationships in terms of, but it basically extends the personality to the people involved in both sides of the House.
Bill Gavin, I don't know if you've read the prepared testimony, but there's a moment after the first meeting between James Comey and the president-elect at Trump Tower in New York. James Comey returns to an FBI vehicle and just begins to hammer out notes of what happened therein. Tell us a bit about the culture of note-keeping and record-keeping within the FBI. James Comey pointing out that he had two meetings with the previous president, Barack Obama, and did not feel compelled to do this. How much does an FBI agent, an FBI director, journal what he does?
David, it's not necessarily just the director. I want to say it's all agents. It's all the assistant directors that run things. What happens is, you know, he didn't document, as Jim Comey said, he didn't document anything with Barack Obama, but he did when he started talking to President Trump. Bottom line is, it's a mechanism that goes off inside your head. It's a little bell that says, I need to record this conversation. It's an uncomfortable feeling, perhaps, or it's a feeling that says, this is going someplace else, and I want to make sure I'm on the right side of recording this the way I remember it. And many, many agents and administrators in the Bureau do that kind of stuff.
Mr. Gavin, you remember, no doubt, John Bailey, also out of Massachusetts, who died in the line of fire for the FBI in Las Vegas over 20 years ago in 1990. If you were to sit down with a president today and the way that he talks about law enforcement in a very simplistic way, I think we can all agree on that. What would you tell the president about the agents like John Bailey?
Well, I don't know as I can tell a president anything, Tom. That's the nature of the beast. The bottom line is, though, I think the president does understand the significance and the importance of a competent, capable, ethical, independent law enforcement agency within the United States government. That has to happen, not just within the United States government, but within the municipalities as well. They have to have all those qualities. And I think the president fully well understands that. And knowing full well that there are every one of the people that have sworn, the fine men and women of the FBI, would give their life for their country and for his life, too. So it's I think he understands that.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. Bill Gavin, thank you so much for your time today with Bloomberg Surveillance. Mr. Gavin is a former assistant director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. David, this has been amazing. I can't say enough about the many conversations we've had with FBI agents.
Yeah, over these last few weeks. And again, we're going to be looking ahead to some confirmation hearings for the man the president intends to nominate to head the FBI, Christopher Wray, formerly of F. King Spalding, who'd been at the DOJ for a long and by all accounts distinguished career. We'll be following that. And of course, that's going to take some focus here after the hearing today with James Comey on Capitol Hill.
What'd you learn last night in Washington? You were out and about. I mean, everybody's focused on this.
I got in here late, but it's been interesting to hear everyone's perspective on what stands out the most from the written testimony that James Comey's going to read from today. A lot of people talking about remarks the president made about the cloud hanging over the White House and how this investigation was preventing him, in his estimation, from doing what he wanted to do. Seems like there's some consensus here that's the major theme from what we've read.
A lot going on here. We thought we'd go finance on you right now. How strange, David Gura. No politics. No IR.
John Tucker nodding in approval, I know.
Praveen Quarapati of Credit Suisse with us now. On the Fed and what we know about inflation, first of all, why is the market so removed from the Fed about where inflation is? What do derivatives tell you?
Well, we have seen inflation break-evens come off quite a bit since the election, since immediately after the election. And part of it is also actual inflation readings have been softer than expected. Now, the Fed is insisting that this is temporary. They're willing to look through it.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen. I think markets have bought the lowflation idea a little more than the Fed has. We'll see who's right over the next couple of readings.
The five-year break-evens, which is a pro phrase, folks, for looking out 5 years and then 5 years from there, is that a good indicator? Mm-hmm. It seems a convenient indicator. Does it actually tell us what the market believes?
In a way, it does. And certainly that's something the Fed looks at as well. The question is, are they right? Well, oftentimes they've moved a fair amount with really little new information. So sometimes it could be technical, but certainly it's something the markets look at, and that's the best market gauge that you do have.
In honor, David, of the complete focus on Washington today, I am going to do a five-year break-even chart with a Fibonacci overlay just to push against the Comey testimony.
I'll be showing that to everyone here in our bureau.
Yes, please.
We're here with Praveen Quarapati on Bloomberg Surveillance. Help us look ahead to the Fed meeting next week. We're anticipating we might get some more color on what the balance sheet unwind is going to be like. Do you think we're going to get anything more on the inflation outlook or the balance of risk?
I think the balance of risk, the Fed has moved from, for a while now to a more balanced approach. And certainly, I think the bigger concern that might come through is what's happening to inflation.
Yeah.
Right. I think in terms of growth, they're comfortable with where we are. So really, the question is how they address inflation. To us, that's the more interesting point. Now, with regards to balance sheet, you might get a bit of a bit more color, but the staff proposal that we saw in the last minute was very, very gradual. It's literally watching paint dry. And so if you get, some indication that is, in fact, where the actual voting members are, this may prove to be a much less impactful event.
What do you use as you get closer to June 14th? Is there some
mechanism?
That's the right word, David. Thank you. Mechanism that you use to get a clearer picture within all the media blather that we create every day?
So to be clear, there's no uncertainty, at least from market's perspective, about whether there's going to be a June hike, right? That's priced
in. 80-something percent. Yeah.
It's almost certain, right? So the real question is what happens thereafter? What happens in September? Right now, September markets aren't really pricing much of a hike. And that's where the Fed's thoughts on inflation will matter. Now, I will say September is, for different reasons, shaping up to be quite interesting. You have potentially the debt limit, debt ceiling being raised, budget needs to be passed. So there are a bunch of things, and then potentially German elections and Italian elections. So that might give the Fed some pause. Markets are aware that there's this timing issue, so there's not much price in September at this point.
Okay, we got to come back and do some more charts. I'm putting out this chart now for David Gurr to get him away from
Fibonacci overlay.
Yes, Fibonacci. Very good, David. Praveen Kurapati with us, in charge of Fibonacci overlays at Credit Suisse. We'll continue our discussion. Wonderful research on really, really arcane finance and the dynamics of the derivative market. We'll continue with a discussion on that. I want to bring in a little bit of fat tail thought here as well. It's a good time to have Praveen Kurapati with us with Credit Suisse and derivatives in fixed income and looking at what our central banks do. I'm going to call it a pretty careful sinusoidal function. Euro spike higher, spike stronger, and then massive abrupt reversal to a weaker euro and now some stability. The headlines were actually pretty interesting. Mr. Yeah. Draghi got out in front of his press conference with a set of headlines, didn't he, Praveen?
Yes, he did. We were expecting, though, a bit more of a removal of some of the more dovish elements of their forward guidance. They did some. For example, they did drop the lower reference in terms of the rates, but we also thought they would modify the well past the end of asset purchases to just past. Right? It's, I know I'm shading words here. But
I'm shocked. Excuse me. Colin, we have a derivatives guy in the house, and he's shading words. Okay. Protect the children. Continue.
Yeah. So I think there's a bit of, reassessment of how quickly they may pull back some of the stimulus, but largely it was in line with what we expected.
Yeah, and we're right there right now. We're, within pips of where we were in line. If I look at the ECB, and with all the focus in Europe, obviously, how do I bring that over to June 14th in Chair Yellen? Because she's got an inflation vector, which they've bought a full boat, and it's rolled over a little bit. They've got this rolling over, that rolling over, GDP, who knows. How does all this roll over to June 14th?
So the inflation problem that you mentioned is something the ECB has as well. Right?
Yes.
So I think the stance lots of these central bankers are taking at this point is basically that we'll look through it for now. And I think the Fed has telegraphed that they will do that in June 14th. Beyond that remains to be seen.
We just don't know.
Yeah.
Praveen, how big a deal is this? Again, I look at the headline, they're omitting that guidance, interest rates might be cut again. Is it taking a big step, a small step here? Help me understand just the gravity of the move that the governing council's made.
I would say it's a small step. It's something that markets were largely expecting. And that's part of the reason is several ECB speakers have been clear that they see in terms of the economy that there's no longer any downside risk, right? So if that's your view of the economy, I think it's appropriate to be removing that language.
And now your geek moment for the morning, folks. Here's the headline. ECB drops reference to lower rates in forward guidance.
Right.
When you and I studied derivatives, forward guidance didn't exist. There were difference equations, ex post, ex ante, T plus one, T plus two, and you struggled through first order and second order difference equations. Is forward guidance nothing more than a PR event? Is it nothing more than almost a marketing campaign by well-meaning economists?
I would say it's more than a marketing campaign, particularly if you view the central bank as credible, right? And you can make the argument that both the Fed, post-Volcker and certainly the ECB have earned some amount of credibility.
Yes.
So if they pre-commit to, say, keeping rates stable.
Yeah, but they don't pre-commit. They change. If the facts change, I change. They do canes if things change.
They do. But again, this is where credibility is important. I would say if there are small changes in the economic outlook, they probably stick to the forward guidance so as to be credible.
Right.
But if there are large changes, they will make the change that you mentioned, and I think markets will sort of overlook that.
Okay, let's go to Bullard's small paper, and Jim Bullard of St. Louis has sat on surveillance and said it is a small paper worth study. He wants a regime change where we wait and we don't worry about T plus one, T plus two, forward guidance, dots, and the rest, until we see a regime change. What's really going on in the last 4 weeks is disappointment that the regime change isn't regiming, is it? I mean, it's not happening.
I think there's some of that. I think there's a concern that, you know, maybe we aren't getting out of this low-inflation world after all. So, again, I go back to my point that inflation prints over the next 3 months are key to watch. Growth, remember, has been pretty good. I should say good in the context of this recovery. So it's really what we're talking about is, both we as market participants mm-hmm. and the Fed and the ECB watching inflation.
Excuse me. David, I wanted to bring this up. The Atlanta GDP number uh-huh. is still very nice. It's a ginormous, like President Trump kind of 3.4% GDP.
You're getting the lingo down,
but
Tom.
It's at the low end of the range.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, Mr. Comey's going to comment on the Atlanta Now GDP forecast, but even GDP is starting to roll over a little bit. I don't want to oversell that. We'll know a lot more about that in the next 4 weeks or so. See how I got Mr. Comey in there, even though
pretty good.
We're talking Gaussian models.
Praveen, let me ask you about personnel and the Fed. Reporting this week that a good friend of surveillance, Marvin Goodfriend, might be considered for a post as a Fed governor, perhaps. What do you make of that? What does that tell you about the direction of the Fed, the way that it's where it might be headed?
No, that's very interesting in terms of, developments for, the composition of the Fed. We have, in some sense, now all three candidates for the vacant slots, right? Now, if you make the assumption that Yellen might stay, which is clearly a questionable assumption, but let's say that's the case.
You're making that assumption?
Not right now.
Okay.
No, we're not. But let's say Trump had to pick one of these three gentlemen as the Fed chair. Now, his good friend, we've heard him on record say he thinks the interest rate should be a lot higher. By lot higher, I mean closer to 2%, which means I think it will be a hawkish addition to the Fed.
To David's brilliant question, way more brilliant than anything I'd come up with, is the idea of rules versus discretion. Mr. Goodfriend clearly tilts over to a more rules-based approach.
I agree.
Is that what we're really talking about here?
Well, yes, but we should also see what the rules are telling you, right? So the rules right now are telling you the rate should be higher. And so the net effect, if you try to gauge what that might mean in terms of the policy rate, it would argue for a higher rate. Now, it's not clear that he'll be able to carry the rest of the committee with him, but certainly that's where he appears to be.
But this is so important. The two-year yield, I did the chart yesterday. I'll send it out again, folks, on Twitter. The two-year yield less the inflation rate is still negative.
Right.
What happens if they raise rates in June and then one more time? Does the world end as we know it?
No, that's a great question. I think we've had negative real rates at the front end for a while.
Just go back to zero.
Right. So we've had it for a while. I don't necessarily think world ends, I think there's some room. Because remember, the Fed is still hiking at a very gradual pace. Now, if they were to accelerate, that might be a problem. We don't see that happening anytime soon. We think they will still be very measured. As I mentioned a little earlier in the show, September, for example, is not automatic, right, in terms of their rate hike.
This has been great. Don't be a stranger. Praveen Koropati with us with Credit Suisse. Next time we'll do Poisson distributions and Taleb and Fat Tails. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. The euro unched pretty much off of the ECB news. No surprise there, really. Unched is very important technical term. But to give us really our first briefing on what we're observing in Washington this morning, what a joy to speak to William Gavin, the former assistant director of the FBI, so associated with Boston. And we say good morning, Bloomberg 1200. Boston and Cambridge and Revere, where Mr. Gavin grew up, and out of Boston College. Now we got to go to the Beltway. David, with our esteemed guest, give us a briefing.
Yeah, Terry Haynes with us here, senior political strategist at Evercore ISI, has been kind enough to join us a couple of times this week here with us now in our Bloomberg 991 studios on what is a big day in Washington, D.C. What are we going to get out of this? There's the pomp and the circumstance. There's the testimony, which we've seen in advance. There's going to be some heated questioning. Where do things go from here? How does this set the investigation on track, on a different track? What do you think we're going to learn?
Good morning, David. Good morning, Tom. And thanks again for having me. Well, I think on track, you know, it's going to – what you're going to see is an investigation that winds out over a period of months or even years. You've had a special counsel appointed just within the past few weeks. Former Director Mueller, that special counsel, is just setting up his own shop, taking briefings from FBI people and others on the status of the investigation, and so they're probably at about the point now where they get started, and they'll wind through this. And you know, as Comey's statement referenced yesterday, you know, they'll do the best investigation they can as quickly as they can, but that is not going to that's not going to go fast. In market time, that's going to be a very slow wind out event without bombshells every day, unlike what we've seen over the past month or so. You know, what we're going to learn today, based on Comey's testimony, is really not a lot new. You know, there's a lot of reference in the political press to, you know, cinematic detail and the like. But fundamentally, two things come out of this written testimony. The first is that Comey confirms that the president is not personally under investigation. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that comes out is really that there's no new detail at all. Things remain somewhat ambiguous, and I don't say that as any sort of Trump supporter or derider. I mean, they just the motivations here remain ambiguous, and ultimately that's up to former Director Mueller to try to figure out. So this is going to take a while.
Terry, we were talking with Gina Martin Adams yesterday. She's our U.S. equity strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence, talking with John Tucker, our friend and colleague as well, expressing a little bit of skepticism here about the market importance of what we're seeing here today. What do you say to them? What do you say to clients about how what will go on in the Hart Senate office building today, how that might matter to markets, if at all?
Well, it matters if there's some sort of bombshell beyond what we already know, to the extent that you know, there's a shade or a cloud, as the president apparently puts it, on the presidency. It matters if there's something that comes out of the Comey testimony that is a significant negative beyond what we already know that he's going to say. If not, then it's not going to be much of a market event, and that's probably the lead dog here.
To be clear here, Terry, and I haven't had this answered yet, does Mr. Comey, is he under an obligation to say everything he knows, or has he basically gone to Mr. Mueller and said, what would you like me to say so I don't impede whatever you're doing as a public servant? Which way does it cut?
It's a very smart question, Tom, and not in the usual Washington sense of it's a smart question, therefore I'm about to disagree with you. It's a very smart question, and the answer is both. He is under an obligation to say everything, but what I want to point out to both David and to you and to listeners as well is that he's not under obligation to say everything he knows in the open session.
I see. Yep.
Just like yesterday, there were general statements made by Admiral Rogers, DNI Coates, and others, and general statements about how they felt their interactions with the president went. But they did not feel comfortable testifying about the specifics in open session. I fully expect that they offered those more specific opinions in the closed session, and there will be a closed session here for Comey this afternoon as well. So, well, what you're going to get is you're going to get generalities from Comey. You are going to get some more specifics from the Intel Committee, who, you know, let's remember, is conducting their own investigation here as well.
Yeah, you know, I wonder the degree to which this is distracting from what Congress would like to be doing. In other words, this is going to create a lot of focus, take a lot of focus away from tax reform or health care reform or the debt ceiling or funding, all of that. How long is that going to continue? Is this a one-day event? You mentioned the long time horizon here we're looking at for an investigation of this nature. How worried are you about legislative agenda items being scuttled because of this?
Well, I'm I'm less worried than most people, and I'm not sanguine about any of this. But I'm less worried about this than most people, but, frankly, because, as I say, this investigation is in these investigations, I should say, both from Mueller's side and from the congressional side, are going to go on for months or even longer. There won't be bombshells every day. There won't be public statements every day or every week, for that matter, I would guess. And so what you're going to get is a return to normality more than anything else. To me, the bigger concern for markets is not so much juice going out of the Trump presidency or momentum from the White House side. It's what is happening right now, I think, is that Congress very much needs the Republican majorities in Congress, particularly on the Affordable Care Act and on tax reform, which are closely linked, as you both know, very much need to get their acts together and to actually figure out what the path forward is on that. If they continue to dissipate and any momentum and bicker among themselves about what the big items are and how and when they're going to achieve them, that becomes a problem, and that has little to do with the Trump investigation. Mm-hmm. Frankly, that needs to be a moment where Republicans get to agree and move forward.
I think most of our audience understands. David Gurin, Washington, this morning. I'm in New York. David Gurin, knowing a lot more about Washington than I do. He's drunk the Kool-Aid for years. And Terry Haynes with us as well, with Ed Hyman's ISI Evercore. Terry, let me bring up a phrase which David Gurin used this the other day. The president used it in the testimony. What's a satellite associate? John Tucker, are you a satellite? Am I a satellite associate?
I think a satellite is that's spun out of control. Oh.
Sputnik. What's a satellite associate?
Tom, I got to say, I think of you as one of the eight big planets rather than than something in the asteroid belt or a dwarf planet.
What's one from Pluto?
Okay. Anyway, exactly.
Tell me about satellite associates.
I want Pluto to come back as a full planet. Yes. Anyway, the satellite associate, I think, is anybody else, very simply. I don't know who.
But critically, they're treated differently. The president is the president, whether it's President Trump or President Garfield or President Jefferson. A president has a different body of law, process, cadence, and discourse, right?
To some extent, but I think if we learned it, we have to talk about Watergate at some point. I think it's required. But the Watergate analogy is appropriate here because what we learned through Watergate and subsequently through a variety of other special counsel investigations over the past 40 years is that the body of law that applies to everybody else by and large applies to the president, too.
David Gurin in our Bloomberg 99.1 studios, Tom Keene at our headquarters in New York. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. We're here with Terry Haynes, the senior political strategist at Evercore ISI. And Terry, I think after the president did that joint speech before a joint session of Congress, there was so much enthusiasm about what he said about infrastructure in this country. Yesterday, he was in Ohio, 6 miles east of Cincinnati on the Ohio River. We saw the barges going by behind him. And this was an opportunity for him to embrace what was supposed to be or what the White House wanted to be Infrastructure Week. Instead, we had a 20-minute windup in which he talked about the Paris Accord, his trip to Saudi Arabia. He talked about healthcare. He finally got to infrastructure there at the end. But for something the White House engineered, wanted to be the focus point this week, we really haven't gotten it. We haven't gotten details on infrastructure from the White House. I hate to draw the parallel here to tax reform, but we're dealing with just a set of principles and little more.
Yes.
I realized that wasn't a question, but I'm curious here just about, we were talking about agenda. Why hasn't the White House been better about claiming that or reclaiming that agenda?
I'm not often surprised, but I am surprised by this. The president has in Transportation Secretary Chao a very skilled operator, not only on policy, but on the ability to bring political consensus. The infrastructure was one of the top things that the president campaigned on. There was a lot of enthusiasm about it among investors as well, and the general public also. And there were a lot of promises made. And to be at a point that's almost mid-year and to not have a plan, to not be engaging Congress on a bipartisan basis and not moving forward is a surprise. And it caused us this week to formally downgrade the chances of infrastructure legislation till 2018. And that matters for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons it matters is because infrastructure, unlike a lot of other government programs, is not something where you merely splash out a bunch of money and all of a sudden things start to happen. That was shown very well in 2009 and 2010 after the stimulus, when lots of shovel-ready jobs and projects were promoted and thought to occur, and it turns out a lot of that didn't happen or happened very slowly. These spendouts happen over a period of 2, 3, 5 years. Mm-hmm. So the delay here is consequential in a policy, in a practical sense, and dramatically slows what the president said was going to be one of his top priorities.
Yeah, it was a freewheeling speech, as I said. There was a moment where he brings up Richard Lefrak. There's the head of Vornado, Steve Roth there as well. He kind of brings them up for a few off-the-cuff remarks. What does it say that he didn't have surrounding this announcement or surrounding this week sort of the panoply of business people we've seen before? Is that an indication to you that what happened with the Paris Agreement, what happened with the G7 summit really has changed or turned or altered the way that business leaders, executives are interfacing or interacting with this administration?
I think it's I think that there's some truth in that. I think it's also true, and this is by inference, but I think it's also true that for whatever reason, the administration is not gathering up those folks and trying to use them as a wedge for action. You know, one thing that Congress always looks for when it's looking for importance is not just importance and a priority in terms of what they should do and how quickly they should do it, is not just what the White House might want or you know how the president's proposing something, but also what kind of support it has out there in the real world from business leaders, from investors, from the general public. And so far, they have not assembled that at all. And it shows a lot of disarray on policy.
Start with a standard idea of why infrastructure is such a struggle in Washington. It's just not in my backyard. Nobody wants the budget in their backyard, isn't it?
Yeah, it's partially that. But, you know, it's awfully bipartisan in many, many ways. For 20, 30 years, I mean, in my professional experience, infrastructure policy, infrastructure legislation has always been bipartisan. The last time we had the infrastructure legislation, most people don't know, was just in December of 2015 when there was a new five-year plan put into place that was largely subsistence, but it was agreed to on a bipartisan basis. And what the president was talking about and what Mrs. Clinton was talking about during the campaign, for that matter, was a ramp up from that level. And that includes both direct federal spending, which we think and continue to think there's about $300 billion available over 3 years, but also an expansion of public-private partnerships, all very bipartisan. There's a win, politically speaking, there's a win out there to be had. And it is mildly surprising to me that the White House and the president aren't seizing that opportunity.
Terry Hands, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Senior political strategist at Evercore ISI joining me here in our Bloomberg 99.1 studios in Washington. Tom.
Yeah, you're near Gucci Gulch, right?
Yes, Gucci is across the street. I can spy it here from our studio on the northeast corner of the building.
Well, we've got a press conference coming up in 6 months. Matt Miller in Estonia, Tallinn, Estonia, with Mr. Draghi, and then on to the Comey testimony. This is Bloomberg. Stay with us. I was watching Gabriel Euro Weekend off Inflation Talk. You can, folks, hear the cadence of the words and look at the Bloomberg and see things give way. There's a lot of uncertainty about inflation right now, isn't there, Gabriel?
Yes, there is. But I think that's partly because market participants want things to move steadily in one direction. If inflation is rising, you would like inflation to keep rising. If inflation is falling, you want it to fall. You don't want it to be on a vague but erratic upward trend, which is my view of where we are right now. And that is sowing confusion, particularly at a time when central banks still are concerned that inflation may not be strong enough for them. And I can understand market uncertainty. I think it's possibly exaggerated.
Gabriel, how effectively is this ECB, is Mario Draghi's ECB, being patient, confident, and persistent?
Well, he certainly is being persistent. He certainly projects confidence.
Yes.
How patient is he? Well, I would actually... look, the ECB has done well in the sense that inflation is headed towards targets. Compare this where we were 2 or 3 years ago. Compare money and credit growth with where we were 2 or 3 years ago. They've done very well. However, I'm not entirely sure how much of this is really the ECB's doing. As you know, I'm a monetarist. I look at money and credit data. Broad money started growing quite rapidly and started picking up in the euro area before the ECB started its asset purchases. So it may have been helped by it, but that deflation was no longer a threat. That was already clear 3 years ago. I think the ECB's policy is helping. I don't think it's doing any harm. But it's also very clear, in spite of what Mr. Draghi says, that there is a lively debate inside the ECB where particularly the Germans are not happy with ultra-low interest rates and with what they perceive to be bailing out of foreigners.
Yeah. I'm watching the screen here, folks, and there is some correlation going on a weaker euro. Gabriel, we've got time for one final question this morning. As you mentioned, the Germans are watching this. I'm looking at a rollover in the German two-year to further negative low rates. Now, not the record lows that we saw in February, the last week of February, but the last week or 10 days or 14 days has been ugly for the German two-year to lower negative rates. How does the Bundesbank perceive that?
It's a look, apart from being concerned, I think that they're obviously worried about what it means in terms of what is it markets perceive that they don't perceive. The Bundesbank sees inflation is picking up, the economy is going great guns, we want higher interest rates. Why are markets incapable of taking that on board? If you'd asked me 2 months ago or a month ago, I would have said it's political uncertainty.
Yeah,
but that should no longer be the case. I think the Bundesbank is as confused as we are, but I also think the Bundesbank is happy with the ECB, for all its dovish tone, having made at least one tiny little hawkish move.
Right.
No more rate cuts.
Well, Gabriel, we've got to cut it off there. Gabriel Stein with RGE, Forecast RGE. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate you staying around. Marty Schenker joining us in our studios in Washington, 99.1 FM studios. He is head of all of government and politics today. He is supposed to be at Hart 216, but fell on the general's sword and gave it up for two corporals, a colonel and a couple first lieutenants who may not survive. Marty, before we go to Greg Villiers, if you were at Hart 216, what would you be listening for today?
Well, you know, the key thing is there anything in Comey's back pocket that he has withheld and is just waiting for the right question to provide it? He has a history of doing that kind of thing. Whether that'll happen today, that'll be the key thing. Is there anything new?
Thank you so much, Marty, for joining us today. Let's dive into some questions. Joining us now, there is only one guest we can have right now, and that is Gregory Villiers of Horizon Investments. What I love to do, Greg, in your morning note for Horizon is go in and find the one classic Villiers sentence. And there it is, wild cards. Does anyone have anything on tape? Oh, you Watergate type you. I mean, that's the kind of bombshell. Can we really find out today if there's something on tape? Oh, John Dean?
Well, I sort of agree with Marty. I think he made a very astute point. There could be a wild card here. In addition to tape, what about the leakers? Who were the leakers? What were their motives? What about these salacious sex tapes? What about financial entanglements? There's a lot that could come up during Q&A.
What does he do when these embarrassing questions, or sensitive questions, I should say, are asked? Does he plead the fifth? Does he plead the seventh? What does he, what's he do?
Well, his silence would speak volumes, wouldn't it? If he refuses to answer a question about Manafort or, you know, there's so many angles to this story. If Comey says, no, I can't go there, I think it'll just raise suspicions even more.
Let me bring in my colleague in Washington with Greg Villiers. Here is Marty Schenker. Marty?
Yeah, well, among other things, like Watergate, these hearings do tend to bring some of the senators themselves, the questioners, in focus. And if you, for those of us who remember the Watergate hearings, Sam Ervin became basically a cultural star through his his questioning during the Watergate.
Marty Villiers was too young.
Oh, come on.
I wish.
No, but it'll be interesting to see who kind of pops on that screen today.
You know what I'm going to look for, guys, is the Republicans. We all pretty much know the Democrats will be scathing. But I thought it was interesting. Last night, Paul Ryan was quite critical of Trump. He said it was inappropriate for Trump to ask Comey to stop the investigation of Flynn. So let's see if this starts a trend of Republicans who get critical.
Let me paint the picture right now, Marty. Another question for Greg Villiers. But first, looking at Hart 216 off our Bloomberg studio monitors here, for those of you radio worldwide and coast to coast, it is a ginormous room. You could play a Predators-Penguin hockey game in it with about 100 photographers milling around waiting for the next image, the empty seat of Mr. Comey, and all the senators. None of them have sat yet. And above are the boxes David Gura was talking about where the media will look down. Behind Mr. Comey is, I'm making a joke, acres of people like Marty Schenker ready to listen with
I'm
every
in a radio
breath.
Studio.
Marty, a question for Greg, please. But Marty, really, all that's missing from the days of Senator Ervin and Senator Baker is the cigar smoke.
Yeah, that's right. It is definitely riveting this town. And I would say in most businesses across America or anybody who's at home, they're going to be watching this. And That has a lot of risks for this president, right? Because everybody will be turning on every word. And if in case there is a wild card that comes out, it's going to be through social media, just wildfire, not just here in the U.S., but around the world.
And if I could add something, guys, political capital is so important in this town. There's a poll out this morning showing Trump's job approval rating down to 34%. If he gets under 30 this summer, his political capital will be such that a lot of Republicans will abandon him.
And that has implications for policy, right? Because
absolutely.
He has a lot of things on his plate in front of Congress.
Now, here we are with Greg Villiers and Marty Schenker waiting for the testimony. It's a good 24 minutes. Wait, Greg, let me get in one more question here, if I could. I guess the president's going to tweet and make a response. How's the White House doing in organizing the President's Day? Dan Balls, I thought, wrote a really terse column in the Washington Post last night of a president alone. What's the level of aloneness as we go to his testimony?
We may find out, Tom, because apparently Trump's lawyers and his intimates, maybe including Ivanka, have told him, do not tweet today. If he tries to refute every point that Comey makes, that could be used against him down the road. So I think an awful lot of people close to him are saying, take our advice. So we'll find out. He's not known to take anybody's advice.
I would be very surprised to see him tweet in real time, given the fact that, you know, our reporting is that his personal attorney is sitting there watching with him and his legal team. And it would seem to me the moment he raises his iPhone, they're going to say, put that down.
Yep. Easier said than done.
Right.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.